Kid, I gotta tell you, you're just not right for Mad Magazine.
Why not?
Your artwork is bad, and your jokes aren't funny. On the plus side, where'd you get those shoes?
Oh, you like them?
No, it was a joke. I thought it would be good if you knew at least one. Kid, look at me.
Yes, sir?
And second thought, look somewhere else. Look at that avocado plant. Its name is Arthur. Now that's funny. Kid, it's 1964. People need a laugh. All you got is this picture of a fly.
That's not a fly. It's Ed Sullivan. He's trapped in a play by Sam Beckett.
I don't keep up with football.
Sam Beckett writes plays.
Yeah, like I said. Wait a minute, kid. Maybe Ed Sullivan is a fly. He introduces the Beatles, get it? And Vermits Vermits and Topo Scratchio, the little Italian louse. Then Ed buzzes over to the set of Alfred Hitchcock Presents and Hitchcock kills him with a rolled-up copy of Mad Magazine. Now that's funny, kid. I'll give you $25 for that idea.
That was your idea.
Then you give me $25.
I got no money, Mr. Gaines.
And you're not funny. But neither are Wayne and Schuster, and they've been on Sullivan 58 times. It's some kind of Canadian experiment. Now there's an idea. Canada decides, instead of a space program, to develop one joke. Can you write that one, kid?
I don't think so, sir.
Nothing like confidence. I like you, kid. You remind me of how funny I am, because you're not. I'm going to keep you around. How does $2 a week sound?
Great, sir.
Of course, you still owe me for that joke. I'll take it out of your pay.
Well, that's okay, because Mad Magazine is the cultural institution that shaped me, so I could be in a mental institution.
Kid, that was a joke.
My first one. I'm on the road to making $3 a week. So here's a show about Mad Magazine. And now, the only nude model Don Martin ever used, Colin McEnroe.
That's right, and there's actually a part of my body that makes the sound plate. At some point today, we really do have to talk about the sound effects in Mad Magazine. And it's really the only Mad Magazine about which you would talk about the sound effects, but that's one of the many ways in which it is completely unusual. So I'm holding what I believe to be the latest issue of Mad Magazine, and there's a picture of Donald Trump and Alfred E. Newman. They both have the Donald Trump hairstyle, and I was kind of thinking, you know, I mean, really, if Donald Trump represents the end of history, which I think he may. This could be like it's the perfect reason to do a show about Mad Magazine, and perhaps it'll be the last Mad Magazine ever because history will end, and on a perfect note, Alfred E. Newman and Donald Trump side by side. All right, so many things to talk about here, but first of all, let me tell you who we're going to talk to about these things. John Ficarra is in a studio in New York, NPR Studios in New York. He's been executive editor of Mad Magazine since 1985, so that means he turns 30 as an editor this year. Joining us by phone, Bill Oakley, a television writer and producer. His credits include Futurama, The Cleveland Show, Portlandia, and The Simpsons, where he worked for 7 seasons and won 3 Emmys. A little bit later, we're going to talk to Bill Shelley. He's the author of Harvey Kurtzman, The Man Who Created Mad and Revolutionized Humor in America. So all of that, plus your phone calls as we go along. But first of all, I think I am going to begin. Yes, Mad is a cultural institution, but it's also a cultural institution that people kind of meet individually. I mean, it's not like a movie that everybody goes to or a play that everybody goes to or a record that everybody buys. It's something that you kind of encounter if you're going to, on your own terms, in your own space, under unusual circumstances. And certainly for me, it really did feel like this Promethean secret, like I was stealing fire. You know, it was sort of the early to mid-60s. It was kind of, there was still this kind of Eisenhower cheerfulness suffusing everything. People were not asking a lot of hard questions or critical questions. Cynicism was not in fashion. And suddenly I found this magazine which suggested that the things in advertising were not true and that many of the things that I had been told were good were not. And I felt just like this portal opening, taking me to a world that I had never inhabited before. So I'm guessing this might have happened with both of the guests that we're going to start out with. John Ficarra, maybe you could just talk about yourself as the young reader of Mad as opposed to its executive editor. What was your epiphanic encounter with it?
Well, you could just replay the tape of what you just said, because I think that's pretty universal. And like, oh my God, this magazine exists and it's talking to me. And we get that so often. And the other thing we get very often is, and I remember, and then the person proceeds to tell me their favorite article of all time, and they can usually recite it verbatim. And it's rarely the same article. I mean, sometimes it's a song parody, sometimes it's a Don Martin gig, sometimes it's a Dave Berglide aside of, but something touched them and got into their system. I guess it's like the chicken pox virus. Once you got it, you can't get rid of it. And they just remember it and remember Mad very fondly as a real touchstone.
I think that's an interesting point, and I'll just press you on it a little bit, that, you know, that everybody's favorite Mad thing, it just isn't the same thing. I mean, I put something up on Facebook today, and right away somebody said, well, you have to talk about 43-man Squamish or Scram.
Yeah.
Like, I sort of remember that, but I mean, it wouldn't be the first thing that jumped into my head. But so
it's funny. That is the most reproduced Mad article ever.
Really?
Because so many people like it and keep writing in saying, can you reproduce it? Yeah.
So we should say what that was. So it was a game that somebody and Matt invented.
The writer was Tom Cook. The artist was George Woodbridge. I like to give them props. And it was just this ludicrous game that you played. And it was total nonsense. But it, again, touched the nerve. And suddenly we're getting photos of colleges where on campus they were forming teams and trying to play this stupid game. And they had helmets and nets at the ends of sticks and everything. We were as stunned as anybody. This predates me. This is all folklore and mad now. But 43-man Squamish, to this day, people say, I still get letters. Oh, gee, I remember this game that was a 43-something. I don't know. Could you just reprint it or send me a copy of it? It's just one of those things.
And actually, there's a line buried somewhere in the piece that turned into the title of a bootleg Pink Floyd album. It's something like, my uncle is sick, but the road is green, or something like that. It's like these weird little tropes that sort of survive in various ways. So, Bill Oakley, I want you to join this conversation. I know that you weren't raised on the teeming streets of Brooklyn, and the way that you encountered Mad is kind of interesting and familial and attic-y. So tell us that story.
Yeah, I was raised, I grew up in the country out in rural, I don't know, Maryland, northern Maryland, and my brother had gone off to college, he was much older than me, and left the attic full of pretty much every Mad magazine from 1960 to 1970, and that's where I discovered Mad. That's where I learned how to read, as a matter of fact. I was always venturing up there looking for old toys or whatnot, and I happened upon all these old Mads, and I had the same, I don't need to repeat the Revelation story, which you guys just told, but it was exactly the same thing, except I was kind of going back to a time before I was born and getting acquainted with the Eisenhower administration and JFK and Khrushchev and that kind of thing. So then I finally caught up and started buying my own Mads in like 1972. But it was a similar story.
So if you learned to read by reading Mad, were you under the impression that Potter ZB, or however you pronounce that, was a real word?
Yeah, briefly, I think, yes. And for Schlugener and all the other ones.
Because that's one of the great things about Mad. We're all laughing because Mad introduced a language. It was often this kind of fusion. It was sort of fake Yiddishisms, but it was actually its own very specific language.
Patrzyjewski is a Polish word.
It is. Okay.
Yeah, but I'm not sure what it means.
And you're the executive editor of Mad, and you don't know what it means.
Well, we've gotten so many translations on it from different people. Oh, no, it means this, it means that. So we've decided it really means nothing, but it is Polish.
One of the great things about Mad, and one of the things that, of course, reinforced everybody's bond with it, was that your teacher hated it. If your teacher knew that you had it, she would take it away. If it was in your desk in fifth grade, it would be confiscated from you. That your teacher had never read it, but your teacher somehow or other knew that it was A, subversive, and B, as she would say, trash. Well, go ahead, John. I can hear you getting ready to react.
One of the things that we really pride ourselves in, one of the gestalt of Mad, is that we want you to question authority, to think for yourselves. And that is the worst thing you want to tell a student, especially in grammar school. And the teacher wants to get that thought out of their heads right away because they don't want anarchy in the classroom. So we have always been hated by teachers.
But I think also, and Bill, I think this is particularly where some of the stuff that you've worked on comes in. You can't really enjoy a lot of Mad if you are not somewhat invested in Western civilization. I mean, and its destruction, obviously. But, you know, I mean, I remember reading a JFK parody that was based on HMS Pinafore. I remember this goes back. You'd have to go into the paperback books, which, Bill, I know you have. Sometimes Mad would just print a poem, a classic poem verbatim, and illustrate it in a really funny way. So you'd read Rime of the Ancient Mariner or Casey at the Bat or something, and there'd be all these terrific illustrations of them. And there was this kind of sense that, although your teacher thought it was trash, in fact, in order to get the jokes, you actually had to know something, which I think, you know, I realize the Simpsons writer's room occasionally looks like some kind of Harvard annex. You know, it's sort of the same thing, right? There are all these jokes that you can't be stupid and understand this.
You know, it's a cliche, but the phrase broaden your horizons comes to mind. Mad drew and draws from such a, you know, from such a huge variety of American experience that, you know, you're like, I know a lot about Estes Kefauver from reading Mad, you know, and things like that, which I never would have had any acquaintance with otherwise. And it's true. It definitely, you know, to repeat the cliche, it broadens your horizons. It draws from such a wide rainbow of American culture that, like, you know, you can't help but learn stuff.
You know, and I think here's the one of the other revelations that might have touched some of us more than others, like maybe the three of us more than others. Another revelation that sunk in at some point was that there were people being paid to write this stuff, you know, that this was a job that somebody had, that you could actually write stuff that was funny, you know, and sort of not funny like the way the New Yorker was funny, but funny in a way that, you know, people you know knew even as a young guy would laugh at. So, so John, I know that at a certain point you started to get some of those really sort of just unforgettable Mad Magazine mass-produced rejection notices. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I started sending to Mad, I think, when I was in second or third grade. And I was an early underachiever. And they, of course, I immediately got back the rejection slips. And Mad has a rejection slip where it's a couple of funny paragraphs, and it ends up with, well, you've been rejected for one of the following reasons, and then there's a checklist where, you know, we've done it, we don't want to do it, whatever it says. So I had a very large collection of these. And I went all through grammar school and high school trying to send in stuff, reject. And then I guess I was just starting college, and I got back in the mail, because this was well before email, I got back in the mail from Nick Meglin, who was then an associate editor, "This isn't right, but keep trying, you're getting close," which was the ultimate thing that you could get as a freelance writer, especially somebody who never really published anywhere. And that was all the impetus I needed to just keep trying and trying. And eventually I got back at, "We like the idea, but not your lines. Will you sell us just the idea?" And I wrote back, "Well, yes, I will, but let me try writing lines first." And I wrote, I guess, about 150 one-liners for the article. And I had no idea what they were looking for, so I was just throwing anything out that came into my head. And eventually I got 24 that worked, and that was my first sale. And other sales begat that.
So, and Bill Oakley, to what degree did all of this begin to make you think about, I don't know if you ever got mad rejection letters, but at some point you decided,
I have a few of my own, yeah.
You do? Yeah.
Congratulations.
Because there's another one, I think, where Al Feldstein sent out, where he talked about how their therapist had told them not to do certain things. And at the end, he said, you know, that it could have been worse. Your material might have been accepted. And then where would you be? So Bill, at one point, did you or to what degree did the existence of Mad put you on some kind of road that you're still on?
You know, to be honest, I started out as a cartoonist, and I don't think I was ever in this. I realized I was not in the caliber of the cartoonists in Mad, and I wasn't. I didn't even try to submit cartoons. I started submitting articles a little later, and I don't know. It, you know, it didn't even occur to me that it was possible to make money doing that until much later. I felt that it was too amazing until I was like in college. It didn't even occur to me that it was possible, you know, to make money doing that, because it was such a pantheon of, like, you know, of all those guys, I didn't think you could break in there.
Well, it was a very close shop. You're absolutely right. I mean, I was the first person they hired in 24 years. That's why you saw the same names over and over again. And Gaines liked it. Bill Gaines, the publisher, liked it as a small mom-and-pop operation. And you really had to do something amazing, especially on the art end more than the writing end, because they felt, well, we got Drucker, who does the movie satires, and got Davis, who does the sports. And, you know, you got Berg, who does Americana. So what are you bringing to the table that we don't already have with the greatest guys who do that sort of thing? So
it was
very, very tough to break in.
So, and Bill, I would assume also that one of the other influences of Mad, so one of the things, if you like Mad, I mean, there's all kinds of things within Mad that you can like. And I'm a big fan of some of the earlier work that had these sort of highly overpopulated panels where, as you looked at the panel, I mean, there was something that was, you know, at least nominally four square and center, but there was all this stuff going on the margins and things posted on the walls and things written on people's chests and people in the background doing
God. We call that chicken fat.
Chicken fat. I love chicken fat.
That's the office term for that, chicken fat.
So chicken fat is great. And it sort of was, Roy Blunt calls this being funnier than necessary. This kind of notion that it really isn't just enough to just deliver one big joke, that somehow or other you almost have to distract people from whatever the one big joke is. And I see that, Bill, in a lot of the stuff that you've been involved with. Does that resonate at all?
Absolutely. You know, I don't think I ever drew that parallel until right now, but it's totally true. You know, I consider Starchy to be my favorite Mad thing of all time, probably. And, you know, it's just packed from wall to wall with the chicken fat. And I think that, yeah, we feel, certainly people I've worked with feel like we're not really fully delivering if we don't cram something into every panel, even if you have to freeze frame to see it. And I think that's probably where that same ethos came on The Simpsons, even when, you know, before DVRs, but people had to use video recorders to pause and freeze frame and to read those signs. I think that's probably why we did it. The bar had been set for that kind of thing, you know?
There's a Simpsons episode. I can't put any kind of frame around it other than I believe they're at a Duff beer factory and these bottles are going by. Bottles are going by really fast on this conveyor belt. One of them goes by and it has Hitler's head inside it.
Yeah, that's a perfect example. Yeah.
That's a Mad Mag. That's chicken fat to me. That's a Mad Magazine thing. You know, see, something would flash, would do the equivalent in a panel of flashing by you and you go, wait a minute, what was that?
Never go wrong with Hitler in the comedy world.
Yeah. I'm fairly certain that every single person on The Simpsons, at least in the old days and probably still, was a devoted reader of Mad Magazine. And I think there's a huge amount of ripping off Mad Magazine's tropes in the series, because they're great.
Yes, I have stuff that's still embedded in my mind. I couldn't even tell you the exact Mad Magazine source, but there's a phrase, a left-handed one with a belt in the back. And I was applied to something that couldn't either be left-handed or have a belt in the back. And to this day, there's moments in which I will sort of plagiarize that somehow. It's just sort of stuff that sticks in your head. Hey, we've got to take a quick break here. We're going to come back with more of Mad Magazine. Thanks so much to Bill Oakley, television writer and producer for Futurama, The Cleveland Show, Portlandia, and The Simpsons. We'll be back after this. All right, we're going to talk a little bit about the history of MAD and how it came to be and who made it what it is and what it was. John Ficarra is with us. He's been executive editor of MAD Magazine since 1985. He joins us from the NPR studios in New York and now joining us. Thanks again to Bill Oakley. It was so great to have him on. Bill Shelley's joining us now. He's the author of Harvey Kurtzman, The Man Who Created MAD and Revitalized Humor in America. Before we go to Bill, John Ficarra, over the years, and particularly when I was younger and reading MAD, occasionally there would be obviously usurpers and pretenders to the throne, and they had names like Cracked and Sick and stuff like that. And I never liked them as much as I liked MAD, and some of that may be that I imprinted like a baby duck. But I think another part of this, I was thinking about this today, was that there was, after a while, a sense of what in the movies we call auteurism about MAD, that after a while you really did start to know, who Sergio Aragonés was or who Dave Berg was or who Al Jaffe was, or going back to Harvey Kurtzman, Bill Elder, people like this. If you were the kind of person who read the magazine kind of carefully, it really was the product, as you say, of this somewhat closed team of people who, had this kind of unvarying standard that they hit.
You're absolutely right. In fact, I went even one further. I would know who Gloria Orlando was, who was Bill's secretary and listed on the masthead, and Jack Albert, right, Bill's attorney, who we put Jack Albert lawsuits. For some reason, I would pore over the masthead every issue, in addition to reading every word many, many times. There is some relationship that develops between MAD and its readers that's hard to define, but boy, it's very, very deep.
So let's talk to Bill Shelley a little bit about this. One of the key names, you heard the name Bill Gaines or Mr. Gaines at the beginning of the show. That's one of the key names. But Harvey Kurtzman is maybe the other key name. So in a quick nutshell, Bill Shelley, who was Harvey Kurtzman?
Well, Harvey Kurtzman was a brilliant cartoonist and an innovator and a very talented writer who created MAD back in 1952. And he was the son of Jewish immigrants from the Ukraine who was born in Brooklyn, grew up, and met a lot of the people he'd work with later in MAD when he was at the High School of Music and Art in New York City with a bunch of talented people. And that's how the kind of the MAD clique got started.
And what did they think, what did Harvey Kurtzman think he was doing when he started this out? I mean, what was the purpose of trying to do this if he had to explain the mission of MAD?
Well, initially the impetus for MAD was that Harvey was working on doing war comic books, and he was completely worn out by all the research. And so the idea was, I want to do a comic book that's easy. And the thing that he did from his youth was satirical cartoons of his friends, of his teachers, and things like that. So he naturally decided, well, I'll do an easy comic book about satire and make fun of things, and there's no research in doing that. There's just the stuff that me and my friend, my buddies joke about, And so that's how he started doing Mad, was just as an easy comic book. And it gradually developed into something a lot more than that. But it started with a very simple idea.
There's this, first of all, we should say this biography, we should say something about the biography. This is a large biography. It is a comprehensive biography. It is a biography that was not approached casually by you. I mean, this is something you worked on for what, about 4 years?
That's right. I mean, I took a break for a few months in the middle to do something else. But yeah, about 4 years ago, my publisher asked me if I'd be interested in doing a biography of Harvey, because he knew I was such a big fan of Kurtzman's work. And of course, I jumped at the chance and it ended up being a much bigger job than I ever thought it would be, because, you know, Harvey Kurtzman is considered one of the gods of comic books, and he's a genius and a brilliant creator and somebody who's influenced so many people. It's just hard to even, you can't even exaggerate his influence.
And so John Ficarra, I mean, first of all, I feel as though Mad, you as executive editor of Mad and Mad Magazine in general, seems keenly aware of its history, maybe a little bit more aware of its history than a lot of publications of a comparable age. I assume, first of all, that as that kid who discovered Mad, you were, although there were two iterations of Kurtzman, and maybe we can get to that, but at some point you became aware of Harvey Kurtzman.
Yes, but the Mad that I knew was really the first started reading was really the post Harvey Mad, because the first 23 Mads were comic book in size and it spoofed other comics, and then with issue 24, the magazine became what Bill Gaines called a slick, which was a black and white but regular magazine size product, and Harvey's vision for it, and Bill can speak to this better than I can, but I think he really wanted to do almost like a funny version of Life magazine. And if you look at issues 25, 26, 27, when Harvey was doing the issues, it sort of looked like that. And then Harvey and Mad parted in, I think, issue 28 over Harvey wanted 51% of the magazine and Bill would not give it to him. So they basically parted ways and Feldstein came in as the editor, Al Feldstein. And he really took the magazine in a much different direction than Harvey did. But for everyone's benefit, that became the magazine that I think most people identify as Mad. It was under Feldstein that Don Martin came in, and we started the movie parodies, and Dave Berg, and The Folden, and Al Jaffe, and the snappy answers to stupid questions. All of that came post-Harvey in the Feldstein years.
You know, I mean, a whole bunch of names that we just said brings me, Bill Shelley, to one of my other points, which is that, you know, your Kurtzman biography reminded me that Mad, even maybe more than early radio and sitcoms, was this kind of huge sledge piled with Jewish humor, dragged into our midst by draft animals who were underpaid writers and artists from Brooklyn. You know,
they're still underpaid, by the way.
That's good. That's good to know. But so the twin towers of American humor, I think, are Jewish and black, right? These are the rhythms, the beats, the motifs of American humor are those two strains, both from oppressed people. And it's one of the things you explore a little bit in the book is I mean, this was for, you know, a Gentile living in West Hartford, Connecticut, that's me, this was an introduction to a style of humor that wouldn't have reached me any other way. I don't know, maybe, Bill, you can say more about that.
Well, yes. I mean, I think the Jewish humor in Mad that sort of thing is something that made Mad sort of an exotic sort of publication. Imagine you're living in, Iowa or something, and you're getting this magazine with various terms, and they invented their own language, too, with Verschlagener and words like that, Potter Zibi. It all gave Mad a very unusual quality, and I think people found it even more fascinating as a result of that. Instead of being repelled by anything like that, people were drawn in by it.
We're coming up on a break here, but very quickly, one of the things that was clear, Bill, also, was that if it was funny enough, nobody could do anything about it, that you could speak truth to power if you were making everybody laugh. So even J. Edgar Hoover, although he was briefly tempted to do something about Mad, didn't dare do it. And a show business titan like Ed Sullivan's reaction to being skewered in Mad was what? To ask for the original artwork, right?
Right, exactly. I mean, people loved it, and people always wanted to have their TV shows and their movies satirized in Mad. Of course, the movie satires actually did start with the Kurtzman Mad. There were many movie satires in there. All those people wanted to be in the pages of Mad. It was just like being made fun of on Saturday Night Live.
All right, we're going to grab a quick break here. We're going to be talking more about Mad Magazine. John Ficarra is going to tell us a lot more about the present of and future of Mad Magazine. And Bill Shelley is the author of Harvey Kurtzman, the man who created Mad and revolutionized humor in America. So we'll take a break. And by the way, we will take your phone calls after this break. So tweet us your pithy remarks at WNPR Colin.
Today's show was produced by the usual gang of idiots, Jonathan McPants and me, Kyone Wolf. Greg Hill appeared on maps of hills named Greg and in our intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. Our interns are Dan Schultz and Sarah Flaherty. The part of Bill Curry was played by Alfred E. Newman. For show pages, articles, and photos of the Here and Now staff acting out spy versus spy cartoons, visit our website WNPR.org/Colin. And now, back to Colin.
I'm sure somebody at Mad Magazine is working on a Marco Rubio's Water Habit parody also as well right now, but the magazine keeps up very well with things. John Ficarra is with us. He's the executive editor of Mad since 1985. We've got a lot of people calling in. I want to get to them, Jennifer in particular, because I want to talk about the relationship between women and Mad. But before we get to Jennifer, just one thing I do want to ask about, John. So, you know, I mean, it doesn't take very long to find people who are influenced by this. I mean, you heard Bill Oakley say that probably everybody who ever wrote for The Simpsons was a Mad Magazine writer. Our producer, Jonathan McNichol, found Roger Ebert saying, "I learned to be a movie critic by reading Mad Magazine. Mad's parodies made me aware of the machine inside the skin." Stephen Colbert, talking about David Letterman, said his disregard for status and respectability, that's it. It reminded me of Mad Magazine that way, to say nothing of the fact that David Letterman slightly resembled Alfred E. Newman. And I can't find any proof, but I would stake my life on the idea that Tom and Ray Maliazzi, the Car Talk guys, were just weaned on Mad Magazine. I mean, it just has to be the case. Everything about their style of humor suggests a deep familiarity with those comic tropes. Do you have one or two other favorite examples of people who just sort of surprise you by having turned out to have grown up reading Mad Magazine?
2 years ago, we did a book called Inside Mad, and I was looking for someone to write a celebrity intro for it. And I reached out to Judd Apatow, and he immediately jumped on it. Mm-hmm. And right after that, I started getting letters and inquiries from other people saying, I'd like to write something. And we got this tremendous caliber of people from all walks of life, everyone from the Ken Burns, the documentary filmmaker who grew up reading Mad and loved it. Obviously, Weird Al Yankovic, who I think is just the embodiment of Mad music. Roseanne Barr wrote a terrific article about how she was the only Jews living in Salt Lake City, and her father would go down to the drugstore and read the issue on the stand. And after a while, the drugstore owner got mad at them and said, you know, this isn't a library. And her father got very upset about this and stormed out of the store, but not before taking one of the subscription cards. And she said that was the only card that the only magazine that he ever subscribed to was Mad. And what got him most was seeing all the Jewish names on the masthead and in the credits of the magazine, really sticking it to powers that be. He just thought that was the greatest thing as a Jew living in Salt Lake City. And then I got almost the identical thing from another comedian who said that he was George Lopez, who was growing up and saw the name Sergio Aragonés and Antonio Prohias and a couple of other Hispanics' name in the magazine, and what that meant to him growing up, that Hispanics could thrive in the comedy business. So we're never quite sure who we're touching, but it's an amazing amount of people all over the planet.
So the Roseanne Barr story gets us right to Jennifer calling from East Granby. Hi, Jennifer. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Good.
Good. So what is it? Well, I, when I was growing up, I was the only girl I knew who read Mad Magazine, and I could never understand why everybody wasn't reading Mad Magazine.
Well, I can tell you that my ex-wife was a Mad Magazine reader and really maybe the person responsible for my whole Promethean stealing fire theory of Mad Magazine. So, John, what can you tell us about that? I mean, there haven't been very many creators at Mad who were women. What can you tell us about the relationship between Mad and women?
there's no question that early on it was an entirely male-produced magazine. And one of the things that Nick Meglin and I tried to do is really change that and bring on more women contributors and hopefully more women readers. It's funny, when we did a demographic survey, Mad is something like 82%, 83% male read. We do have some female readers, but not that many. But the female readers are the more vocal ones. They're the ones who keep writing letters to us and things like that. So I don't know if there were more female closet readers who won't admit it, or maybe our figures are just wrong. Certainly, we don't set out to just write for men. I mean, that is not our – we try to write what we just think is funny. And there's no question that Mad's humor is a little bit more aggressive than the typical female humor. But I'm happy to report that we do have some female contributors now. Teresa Parkhurst Burns is a regular contributor. And in the current issue, there's a terrific sculpture by a gal that we've used a couple of times now. And her name is, I want to make sure I Sarah Shalick did the illustrations, and Kira Sharonova did the sculpture of a Kim Davis doll, like an American American Girl doll. So we are actively trying to bring more women into the fold, and hopefully more female writers as well.
So Jennifer, you know, I know you a little bit, and I know a little bit about what you've done with your life. I mean, do you think Mad shaped your brain in some way?
Absolutely, it did. I think I was drawn to the humor, and I loved the illustrations, and I would spend hours just poring over them, trying to find all the little details. But I think it was mostly the sophisticated language that I liked, and I felt really smart when I read Mad Magazine and understood the words, and sometimes I had to look them up, but then I got even smarter. And I think all that reading and kind of absorbing Mad Magazine kind of influenced the voice in my head, so that now I would never presume to say I write like the writers of Mad Magazine, but I kind of hear that sort of voice in my head when I write, which is what I do for a living now.
All right. Well, listen, thanks for that input. Jennifer, thanks so much for calling. We're talking to John Ficarra, executive editor from Mad. We've got a couple of more calls here that I want to get to, but I also want to make sure we have a little bit more time to talk about some of these personalities in the history of Mad, and also the kind of attitude of Mad. So Bill Gaines, along with Harvey Kurtzman, were kind of the two progenitors of Mad. Bill Gaines' stories are kind of all over the place. John, I'm assuming you have one or two favorites of your own.
Oh, he was great. Bill never wrote or even edited a single word of the magazine, but Bill created the atmosphere that let everyone else flourish. And it was a real genius of how he did it. I think the thing he did most was every year he would gather up the immediate editing staff and all the freelance writers and artists and take them on a trip somewhere in the world.
Didn't he take him to Haiti to meet the one Haitian reader of Mad? Do I have that right?
Yes. That was maybe the first Mad trip ever. And they were off to Haiti. Bill loved Haiti. And he looked up the subscription rolls, and he had one subscriber in Haiti. So when they got there, they took four Jeeps and herded all the Mad contributors, drove up to this poor kid's house, rang the doorbell. And when he answered, everybody was on their knees saying, please resubscribe, please resubscribe, which he did.
Yeah.
And then a year later, a second person in Haiti subscribed. So Bill always pointed to that as proof that the trips really worked, because we doubled our sales in Haiti as a result of that trip. A nice postscript to that story is, right towards the end of Bill's life, he was on the old Bill Costas Later Show. Bob Costas Later Show. And he told that story. And the kid that they met in Haiti was now an attorney in San Francisco and saw the show. And he and Bill were able to get together and have dinner. Mm-hmm. So it was a nice completion of the circle.
You know, one of the ways in which I feel as though Mad Magazine's legacy goes a lot of different places, including to the Simpsons and to any other kind of transgressive comedy, and obviously the work of stand-up comedians now who take no prisoners, is that notion of nothing being sacred, and if you see a tripwire, run toward it as opposed to away from it. And I assume that's still the ethos of Mad, that no matter what it is, there's going to be something funny about it.
Yes, within reason. Yeah. The one thing that Mad never does or ever did was do victim humor.
Mm-hmm.
So when we never made a joke about a patient with AIDS.
Right.
However, Reagan wouldn't say the word AIDS, and we were all over him for that. So we sort of draw that line there. And we'll also, like I said, just never do any kind of victim humor. When Amanda Bynes started acting crazy, we were doing stuff on the blog about her. But once it became obvious that this was just not a spoiled celebrity out drinking every night and making a fool of herself, that she actually had mental conditions, we shut it down. You don't see any jokes about her in, you know, after that. There were bigger fish to fry than us to make fun of victims.
There's a story that I've read about you being stuck in the mad offices on 9/11, sleeping in the office. Did you get stuck there on 9/11?
I did. It wasn't my finest hour, but, you know, I couldn't. I live on Staten Island.
Yeah.
And there were reports the ferry wasn't running. And we're up in Midtown, so I said, I'm going to walk to the ferry, and then there may be no ferry, and I'm going to get stuck down there. So I said, I got a sofa from my office. I might as well just spend the night. So I'm sitting there, and not much happened. I said, gee, you know what? The producer was really hot then on Broadway. I said, maybe I can go down and get a ticket, because I couldn't get a ticket. So I went down, and of course, stupid me,
right,
expecting Broadway to be open on the night of 9/11. And they weren't. So it's even stupider thinking that I could laugh on that night. It wasn't my finest hour.
Mm. But it's great that you can tell that story, too. Let me grab a call here from George in Glastonbury. Hi, George. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
There are a couple of things about magazine that I always admired. I grew up in the 50s and the 60s, and I wasn't an avid reader, but there are certain things you couldn't escape. And the major thrust of the magazine for me was that they could go from very, very low humor to very, very high humor in 60 seconds. And the example of low humor, I don't know if this will connect with anybody because I think it was part of the chicken fat, was the phrase, come in Rangoon. And somebody recognizes it, I think.
Yes.
And of high humor was the composer's edition of Mad Magazine. And they talked about Mozart being so prolific that later in life he was walking the streets of Salzburg whistling, "Bess You Is My Woman Now." And that always tickled me. And speaking of celebrities, I can't believe that Itzhak Perlman didn't approach you about writing something for the magazine, because in person he's, even if he isn't funny, he thinks he's very funny, and I think that kind of humor would be very appealing to him.
Well, you know, a lot of people have approached Mad Mag. I mean, Ernie Kovacs wrote for some of the early issues. I mean, people who had established themselves in other fields, John Ficarra, did want to write for the magazine.
Although the early days was when Feldstein took over and he had no writing staff.
Right.
So what he was doing, he was approaching Ernie Kovacs and saying, would you mind if I adopted some of your material? Same things with Bob and Ray. The interesting thing that happened with Bob and Ray was all the material Feldstein was adopting, he noticed was written by one guy, a guy named Tom Cook, K-O-C-H. And finally he said to Bob and Ray, would you mind if I just went to Tom and asked him if he wanted to contribute directly to the magazine? And they said, no, that's fine. And Tom became one of our greatest legendary writers for years and years and years until he retired. He just recently passed away earlier this year. And he wrote 43-man Squamish, the piece we were talking about earlier. Yeah, so he's just a tremendous writer. I can't give him enough credit.
You know, we're almost out of time here, but I mean, to that point, too, I mean, Gaines was really kind of famous. I mean, Mad Magazine writers, I was joking about, you know, draft animals being underpaid writers from Brooklyn, but that was really kind of the truth, to the point that in Bill Shelley's book about Harvey Kurtzman, there's a description of Harvey Kurtzman being he actually was using some of his own pay to pay some of the writers, because Gaines just didn't have any money to pay anybody.
Yeah, well, the magazine has certainly changed since then. I mean, our guys aren't the best paid, but they can eke out a living, however meager. Another thing about Mad that I don't think most people realize is that Mad, when we did our movie, our song parodies, by the way, we were sued by Irving Berlin because we did a takeoff on Blue Skies called Blue Cross. And Berlin, who was a notoriously litigious guy, sued us and went all the way to the Supreme Court. And it upheld the lower court's decision, the appeals court in New York, and Judge Julius Kaufman, I think his name was, wrote, Mr. Berlin, if I rule in your favor, every time somebody warbles a few bars of your song in the shower, they're going to have to send you some money. He says, you do not own iambic pentameter. And that really set the standard now for, you know, all the morning zoo shows that do song parodies and Weird Al and things like that. It was all based on the Mad Magazine lawsuit.
John Ficarra, we have to stop. I hate it that we have to stop. There's so much more to talk about. But thank you so much for joining us. John Ficarra, executive editor of Mad Magazine. Since 1985, he turns 30 as an executive editor this year. He's been joining us from New York. Thanks to Bill Oakley and Bill Shelley. Also, special thanks to Jonathan McNichol for producing this show. We'll be back tomorrow.
Look out, man!
He's got no brakes!
What would be worried? I don't even care. What would be worried? Worrying can't get you anywhere.
What if we did some sort of audio fold-in, like they have at the back of Mad Magazines where it says something and then you fold it and it says something else? But then I would have to say it backwards? Ugh, forget it. See, this is why we need you to pledge to our station. We need more comedy writers on staff.